I call them the four commitments. I need them to commit to 1. Let go of the past. 2. Tell the truth. 3. Be supportive and helpful, not cynical or negative. 4. Pick something to improve yourself, so everyone is focused more on improving than judging. Almost every coworker agrees to my 4 requests. In a couple of cases, coworkers have just said no. They felt that they could not let go of the past and help my client try to get better. In these cases, they had psychologically written off my client. Since all of the interviews are confidential, I don't tell this to my client. I only request that the coworkers not participate in the final feedback report. If we aren't going to try to help our colleagues, why should we be allowed to judge them? As you contemplate changing your behavior yourself, without my hands-on assistance, you will need to do the same with your colleagues. Here's how you can get the people you know to commit to helping you. First commitment, can they let go of the past? Whatever real or imagined sins you have committed against people in the past, they are long past correction. You can't do anything to erase them, so you need to ask people to let go of the past. This is simple, but it is not easy. Most of us have never forgiven our mothers and fathers for not being the perfect parents. We cannot forgive our children for not being the ideal kids. We don't forgive our spouse for not being the perfect partner. Quite often, we can't forgive ourselves for not being the perfect us. But you have to get this first commitment. Without it, you can't shift people's minds away from critic toward helper. As a friend wisely noted, forgiveness means letting go of hope for a better past. Second commitment, will you swear to tell the truth? You don't want people to work your butt off for a year, trying to get better based on what people have told you that you were doing wrong, and then find out that they didn't really mean it, that they were jiving you, that they were only saying what they thought you wanted to hear. That's a waste of time. I'm not naive. I know people can be dishonest. But if you solicit, no, demand honesty from people, you can proceed with the confidence that you're going in the right direction and that you won't get a rude surprise at the end. Third commitment. Will they be supportive without being a cynic, critic, or judge? This is asking a lot of people, especially if they are in a subordinate position to you. People are just as likely to suspect or resent their superiors at work as respect and admire them, so you have to remove any and all of their judgmental impulses from the equation. Do that, and people are much more inclined to be helpful. At some point, they realize that if you get better, they have won something too. They get a kinder, gentler, better boss. Fourth commitment. Will they pick one thing they can improve in themselves? This is the subtlest commitment, but it only sounds like you're asking a lot from your colleagues. What you're actually doing is creating parity, even a bond between you and the other person. Imagine if you walked into work one day and announced that you were going on a diet. Most people would respond to that announcement with a massive yawn. But what if you announced your plans and asked a colleague to help you? For example, to help you monitor your eating habits and stay on track. Since most people like to help their friends, you'd probably get a much more involved and sincere response to your objective. Finally, what if you add the compelling reciprocal twist of saying, "Now, what would you like to change in yourself? I'd like to return the favor and help you." If you do that, you won't have any problem enlisting support. Suddenly, both you and the other person have become equals, fellow humans engaged in the same struggle to improve. Imagine if you were in a marriage in which both you and your spouse were unhappy being, say, 25 pounds overweight. What if one of you decided to go on a diet and shed those excess pounds? Wouldn't your chances of succeeding increase if you could enlist your spouse to join you on the diet? Suddenly, you'd both be involved in planning the day's meals. You'd both be goading each other to maintain the discipline. You'd both be checking the scale to see how you're hitting your targets. That's certainly a lot better than sticking with your regimen at the dinner table, while your other half continues eating the foods that packed on the excess weight in the first place. The two of you are going in opposite directions. That's an unpromising formula for getting where you want to go. One of you will be miserable. More likely, both. The fourth commitment is the final piece in making the process a two-way exchange, and it is crucial if you want people to stick with you through the 12 to 18-month process. I learned this early on with my clients. When I had to figure out who to talk to for initial feedback, it seemed like common sense to me that the client should pick the people rating his performance. After all, these colleagues were the people telling me what this fellow needed to change. Wouldn't they be in the best position to tell me if and when he was getting better? So I had to draft them into the process and get them to play on my terms, too. I told each coworker about my client's plan to change, and I asked him or her to commit to help. I was being scientifically rigorous and practical. I wanted the folks filling out the first report card to fill out all the report cards. It would make the results more valid and credible. However, it took me a little trial and error to appreciate the massive side benefits of getting other people involved, especially the part where they committed to changing something too. It enriched the entire experience. The client not only changed for the better because he was getting support from his coworkers, but the coworkers changed too because of what they learned by supporting him. This is a rich and subtle dynamic, proving that change is not a one-way street. It involves two parties, the person who's changing and the people who notice it. As you begin your personal self-reclamation project, don't slough off this fourth commitment. Put equal emphasis on changing yourself and the people who will determine whether any change has occurred. You and the people helping you are both equal parts of a delicate equation. You can't ignore the other guy in any personal transaction and think you're accomplishing something interpersonal or engaged in a transaction. Then, and only then, are you ready to solicit feedback about yourself. Finding a bunch of people to tell the truth about ourselves is not hard. You just have to know where to look. I didn't go through the listing of the four commitments to impress you with the rigor of my methodology. It's the criteria you should be applying once you've decided on the people you want to provide feedback. First on your list should probably be your best friend. We all have a best friend at work, someone with whom we don't compete, who has no agenda when it comes to our success, who has our interests at heart. By definition, this person fills the four commitments. If he's our friend, he surely isn't bitter about something in our mutual past, so he won't keep bringing up the past or hold it against us. He's comfortable with leveling with us. He has no reason to lie. He'll consider telling us the raw, unvarnished truth, a badge of honor. He's there to support us, and he'll be willing to play along and get into the change process with us. That would be my first choice, but it doesn't have to be yours. Make a list of the last dozen or so people with whom you've had professional contact. They could be colleagues, subordinates, customers, clients, even long-term competitors. As long as they're people who make legitimate observations about your behavior, they're eligible. Then run the four commitments against each name. If any of them qualify on all four commitments, they're as good a place to start getting feedback as any. Treat it as if you're conducting a voir dire to assemble a trial jury, because that's in effect what's going on here. Remember, this process, especially at the beginning, is not supposed to be difficult. Getting feedback is the easy part. Dealing with it is hard. Stop asking for feedback and then expressing your opinion. Years ago, I was riding an elevator with a famous trial lawyer who was well into his 80s at the time, but still practicing law. The elevator doors opened and a man smoking a cigarette got on. This was in the early 1980s, before smoking was universally banned. The lawyer panicked. He was allergic to smoke, and he vainly tried to jump off the small, cramped elevator so he wouldn't have to breathe the smoke. Too late. The doors closed. "Are you okay?" the smoker asked the lawyer. "You know, you're not supposed to smoke on elevators," he told the man. "It's against the law." The man said, "What are you, a lawyer?" He was in no mood to apologize or put out the cigarette. He was clearly prepared to argue with the lawyer to defend his right to smoke. "I don't believe this," said the lawyer. "You're acting as if I'm wrong, that you're the victim because I happen to be in the elevator while you're breaking the law." It was one of those small but outrageous moments that remind you how defensive people can be, whether they are right or wrong, especially if they're wrong. I think about that elevator ride every time someone asks me for advice, and then after I give it, they render a less than glowing verdict about the quality of my advice. "I can't believe it," I say with the lawyer's words ringing in my ear. "You're asking me for my opinion, and now you're arguing with me. It's no different than our behavior when we argue with someone who's giving us advice, offering feedback, or otherwise trying to help us. And we do that every time we ask for feedback and unthinkingly respond by expressing our opinion. When we ask a friend, "What do you think I should do in this situation?" we are setting up the expectation that we want an answer and that we will give the answer full consideration and quite possibly use it. We are not announcing that we're initiating an argument. But that's exactly what we're doing when we ask for feedback from someone and then immediately express our opinion. This is certainly true when our opinion is negative. I'm not so sure about that. Whatever we say, however softly we couch it, our opinion will sound defensive. It will resemble a rationalization, a denial, a negation, or an objection. Stop doing that. Treat every piece of advice as a gift or a compliment and simply say thank you. No one expects you to act on every piece of advice. If you learn to listen and act on the advice that makes sense, the people around you may be thrilled. Feedback moments. How to get good feedback on your own. I realize few of you have the resources to hire a professional to do the field work of getting great feedback. When I work with executives, I spend my first hours on the job conducting a 360-degree feedback review. I don't want to drape the process in complexity and mystery. It's really simple. With the client's help, I identify all the people he or she works with who see his or her interpersonal challenges on a daily basis. These are the raters. I qualify them with my 4 commitment questions, and I have them fill out a leadership questionnaire. Sometimes the questions are customized to reflect the company's values and objectives. At GE, for example, there's a high premium placed on cooperation and sharing information across boundaries, whereas at another company, the premium value might be customer satisfaction. The questions are simple. Does the executive in question clearly communicate a vision? Treat people with respect? Solicit contrary opinions? Encourage other people's ideas? Listen to other people in meetings? That sort of thing. I ask people to rate their colleagues on a numerical scale. From that, a statistical picture emerges, usually revealing 1 or 2 problem areas that we need to address. Surveys show that about 50% of corporate America uses something like this in evaluating employee performance and attitudes. If, somehow, this format has eluded you, I've included a 72-question leadership survey in an index to give you a picture of how professionals in this field operate. But I'm not asking you to become a feedback professional here. I have to do it this way because I'm a newcomer at every company I work in. I don't have any history with the client. I've never worked with him. All I know before I meet the client is what his or her boss has told me about him, so I have no alternative but to canvass the troops. That said, if you've worked in a corporate environment large enough to have 3 employees in its human resources department, you've probably been a participant in something resembling 360-degree feedback. Even if you haven't, we're all familiar with feedback, whether or not we label it as such. We've all endured performance appraisals from our bosses. That's feedback. We've all gone through salary reviews. That's the most direct feedback. If we're in sales, we've all read customer surveys of our performance. That's feedback. We've sat through quarterly sales meetings as our figures are stacked up against our quotas and projections. That, too, is feedback. We're being told all day long how we're doing, and the reason we accept this feedback and actually attempt to respond to it, e.g., if we're down in sales, we try harder to bring up the figures, is that we accept the process. An authority figure grades us, and we are motivated to do better because of it. It's not like that with interpersonal behavior, which is vague, subjective, unquantifiable, and open to wildly variant interpretations. But that doesn't make it less important. It's my contention, and it's the bedrock thesis of this book, that interpersonal behavior is the difference maker between being great and near great, between getting the gold and settling for the bronze. The higher you go, the more issues are behavioral. So how do we get this much needed feedback if we have neither the skill nor resources nor opportunity to poll our peers on what they really think about us? We know what feedback is. We don't know how to get it. Basically, feedback comes to us in 3 forms: solicited, unsolicited, and observational. Each of them works well, but not for everyone. Let's look closely at all three to see which one's right for you. Solicited feedback, or knowing how to ask. Solicited feedback is just that. We solicit opinions from people about what we're doing wrong. Sounds simple, no? I'm not always so optimistic. I'm not saying that you, working on your own, cannot replicate my feedback retrieval methods. It's quite possible that you could corral a dozen people who know you, qualify them with the four commitment test, and have them fill out a questionnaire about what you could be doing better. My only concern is that we cannot be sure that you will A. ask the right people, B. ask the right questions, C. interpret answers properly, or D. accept them as accurate. This harks back to my big issue with negative feedback. We don't want to hear it, and people don't want to give it. In my experience, the best solicited feedback is confidential feedback. It's good because no one gets embarrassed or defensive. There are no emotional issues because you do not know who to blame or retaliate against for attacking you. In the best cases, you have no sense of being attacked at all. You're merely ingesting honest commentary, which you requested, from blind but well-meaning sources. The only problem, this is virtually impossible for one person working alone to pull off. To maintain the confidentiality and avoid the emotionality, you need an unbiased third party to do the polling, someone like me. Absent that, you have to ask people one-on-one, but that too is fraught with obstacles. In my experience, there are 100 wrong ways to ask for feedback, and one right way. Most of us know the wrong ways. We ask someone, "What do you think about me? How do you feel about me? What do you hate about me? What do you like about me?" These are all variations of the same encounter group question designed to elicit honest feelings between people. Well, we're not running encounter groups here. These types of questions are particularly pernicious in power relationships, where the boss is asking the bossed, "What do you think of me?" In a power relationship, you have all kinds of issues that influence the answer, because the answer has consequences. People will not tell the truth if they think it will come back to haunt them. In a power relationship, subordinates have no guarantee that the unvarnished truth won't anger the boss, send them back to the end of the line, or worse, get them fired. When you think about it, these "what do you think of me" encounter group questions are actually irrelevant. In the workplace, you don't have to like me. We don't have to be buddies who hang out together after work. All we have to do is work well together. How we really feel about each other is practically moot. Think about your colleagues at work. How many of them are your friends? For how many of them would you be willing to articulate your true feelings? How many of them have you actually thought about in terms of feelings? The answer, I suspect, is not that many, a few minority. And yet you probably work well together with the majority of your colleagues. That disconnect between the small number of friends and the large number of colleagues with whom you work well with should convince you once and for all that what people feel or think about you is not the key to getting better. In soliciting feedback for yourself, the only question that works, the only one, must be phrased like this: how can I do better? Semantic variations are permitted, such as, "What can I do to be a better partner at home?" Or, "What can I do to be a better colleague at work?" Or, "What can I do to be a better leader of this group?" It varies with the circumstances, but you get the idea. Pure, unadulterated, issue-free feedback that makes change possible has to A. solicit advice rather than criticism, B. be directed towards the future rather than obsessed with the negative past, and C. be couched in a way that suggests you will act on it, that in fact you are trying to do better. Unsolicited feedback, or the blindside event. If we're lucky, every once in a while, something or someone comes along who opens our eyes to our faults and helps us strip away a delusion or two about ourselves. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, we should consider ourselves lucky and grateful. Scientists have all sorts of schemata to explain us to ourselves. One of the more interesting ones is a simple four-pane grid known as the Joe-Harry window, named after two real characters, Joe and Harry. It divides our self-awareness into four parts, based on what is known and unknown about us to other people, and what is known and unknown about us to ourselves. As you can see from the illustration on the following page, the stuff that is known about us to others is public knowledge. What's known to us and unknown to others is private. What's unknown to ourselves and others is, well, unknowable, and therefore not relevant. The interesting stuff is the information that's known to others, but unknown to us. When that information is revealed to us, those are the road to Damascus moments that create dramatic change. They're the moments when we can get blindsided by how others really see us, when we discover a truth about ourselves. These blindside moments are rare and precious gifts. They hurt, perhaps. The truth often does. But they also instruct. I've had a few in my life, but the most significant blindside event came when I was a 28-year-old PhD candidate at UCLA. Back then, in the late 1960s, the era of Free Love and Woodstock, I thought of myself as being just a little more insightful, more hip than the people around me. I believed that I was intensely involved in things like deeper human understanding, self-actualization, and uncovering profound meaning. I was a student in a small class led by a very wise teacher, Dr. Bob Tannenbaum. Tannenbaum was a revered figure, not only at UCLA, but in psychology circles around the world. He had invented the term sensitivity training and had published the most influential papers on the subject. He was a god to me. In Bob's class, we were encouraged to discuss anything we wanted. I took this as a license to rail against the shallow, materialistic citizens of Los Angeles. For 3 weeks, I delivered a monologue about how screwed up people in Los Angeles were, with their sequined blue jeans, gold Rolls Royces, and manicured mansions. All they care about is impressing others. They do not understand what is deep and important in life. It was easy for me to be an expert on the people of Los Angeles. I had, after all, grown up in a small town in Kentucky. After enduring my babble for 3 weeks, Bob asked, "Marshall, who are you speaking to?" "I'm speaking to the group," I answered. "To whom in the group are you talking?" "I'm talking to everybody," I said, not quite sure where Bob was going with this line of interrogation. Bob said, "I don't know if you realize this, but each time you have spoken, you have looked at only one person. You have addressed your comments toward only one person, and you seem interested in the opinion of only one person. Who is that person?" "That's interesting. Let me think about it," I said. Then, after careful consideration, I said, "You." Bob said, "You're right, me. There are 12 other people in this room. Why aren't you interested in any of them?" Now that I had dug myself into a hole, I decided to dig even faster. I said, "Dr. Tannenbaum, I think you can understand the true significance of what I am saying. I think you can truly understand how screwed up it is to run around trying to impress people all the time. I believe that you have a deeper understanding of what is really important in life." Bob asked, "Marshall, is there any chance that for the last 3 weeks, all you have been trying to do is impress me?" I was stunned by Bob's obvious lack of insight. "Not at all," I said. "You haven't understood one thing I have said. I have been explaining to you the folly of trying to impress other people. You've totally missed my point, and frankly, I am disappointed in your lack of understanding." He stared at me, scratched his beard, and concluded, "No, I think I understand." I looked around and saw 12 people scratching their faces and thinking, "Yes, we understand." I hated Bob Tannenbaum for 6 months. I devoted a lot of energy into figuring out his problems and understanding why he was confused. After a half a year of this stewing, it dawned on me that the person with the issue about impressing other people wasn't Bob Tannenbaum or the citizens of Los Angeles. The person with the real issue was me. I looked in the mirror and didn't look like the person staring back at me. I still shudder with shame at the memory of how fatuous I was back then. But we need these painful, unsolicited feedback episodes when others reveal how the world really sees us in order to change for the better. Without the pain, we might not discover the motivation to change. This was a blindside event for me, not only because it exposed my shallow self-involvement, but it taught me two great lessons that have literally shaped my professional work. One, it is a whole lot easier to see our problems in others than it is to see them in ourselves. Two, even though we may be able to deny our problems to ourselves, they may be very obvious to the people who are observing us. This is the simple wisdom of the Joe Harry window. What is unknown to us may be well known to others. We can learn from that. As human beings, we almost always suffer from the disconnect between the self we think we are and the self that the rest of the world sees in us. The lesson that I learned from Dr. Tannenbaum is that the rest of the world usually has a more accurate perspective than we do. This is the value of unsolicited feedback. And in many ways, when I work one-on-one with people, I am recreating that painful realization inspired by Dr. Tannenbaum. I'm trying to blindside them by making them peer through that fourth window to see what is known to others but unknown to them. If we can stop, listen, and think about what others are seeing in us, we have a great opportunity. We can compare the self that we want to be with the self that we are presenting to the rest of the world. We can then begin to make the real changes that are needed to close the gap between our stated values and our actual behavior. Although he is no longer with us, I still say, thank you, Dr. Tannenbaum. Observational feedback, or seeing your world anew. One of my clients, let's call him Barry, told me about one of the more important insights he had at work. It involved a senior executive who was about a half notch above him in the organizational hierarchy. It's important to know that because Barry handled a couple of accounts that were near and dear to the CEO. Barry had a slightly closer relationship with the CEO than anyone else in the company. He traveled with the CEO and talked to the CEO at least once a day. Barry's access to the CEO was so good that some of his peers, who weren't as tight with the CEO, resented him for it. They felt that because of his perceived special relationship with the CEO, Barry could always go around them and get his way by sucking up to the CEO. It wasn't necessarily true, certainly not to Barry, who had never felt that the CEO had favored him over others. It was envy, pure and simple. But it's important to know that this dynamic may have colored Barry's relationship with his peers. The only strange thing was that Barry had no clue that some of his peers felt that way. He thought they liked him. Then one day, he had a feedback moment. In a group meeting, Barry noticed that a senior executive named Peter was making a pointed effort to ignore him. Whenever Barry spoke, Peter would look away, as if the sound of Barry's voice was causing him pain. Nobody else in the room noticed this, but Barry did. So he started paying attention to Peter's behavior for the rest of the meeting, and what Barry saw confirmed the first clue. When Peter spoke, he would look around the room, making eye contact with everyone except Barry. Even when the discussion turned to one of Barry's responsibilities, Peter would look away. Everything he said and did gave the impression that Peter wished Barry would simply disappear. That's when it hit Barry. Oh my, he thought. Peter, who has the power to block some of my initiatives, hates my guts. Until that moment, Barry told me, I had no idea. I thought we were colleagues. I thought we worked well together. I submit that the subtle signals Barry picked up qualify as significant feedback. Observational feedback. Unsolicited, less than explicit, hard to prove, but important feedback nevertheless. Because it taught Barry that he had a fractured collegial relationship that needed immediate attention. I'm pleased to report that Barry responded brilliantly to this feedback. Instead of being defensive about it, as many of us would be if we learned that someone was harboring a deep animus toward us, he opted to turn the other cheek and begin a campaign to win Peter back to his side. I had options in dealing with Peter, said Barry. I could treat him with kid gloves, work around him, ignore him, start a campaign to undermine him. Or I could show him that I'm his friend, not his enemy, because I needed his support. I decided to make him my friend. I would direct business leads his way and go out of my way to bring deals to his division. I would keep him in the loop on everything that touched him and me by following up and getting his input about stuff I'm working on. I would seek out his advice, show him respect, and hope he responded by no longer ignoring me. It took Barry more than a year, but this excellent behavior converted the hatred into a working relationship. The two men didn't become instant drinking buddies. That would be asking too much. But Peter no longer hated Barry. More importantly, they worked well together. I mention this because it demonstrates A, that feedback from one person, however obtrusive and vague, can be just as important as formal feedback from a group. And B, not all feedback comes from asking people or hearing what they volunteer. Some of the best feedback comes from what you observe. If you accept it and act on it, It's no less valid than people telling you the same thing at point-blank range. Even if we're only half paying attention, we take in observational feedback all day long. We shake hands with a neighbor at a party and notice that he doesn't look us in the eye. We think, what's that all about? Coming home after work, we stroll into our living room, and our 12-year-old daughter immediately leaves to go upstairs. We think, what did we do to tick her off? We try to contact a client or customer, and he doesn't return the call. We think, someone's displeased with us. Every day, people are giving us feedback, of a sort, with their eye contact, their body language, their response time. Interpreting this casual observational feedback can be tricky. Learning that something's not right is not the same as learning what's wrong and how we can fix it. The good news is that these feedback moments are plentiful, and with some simple drills, we can manipulate them so that patterns emerge to tell us everything we need to know to get started. Here are 5 ways you can get feedback by paying closer attention to the world around you. 1. Make a list of people's casual remarks about you. I heard a creativity teacher give her class the following assignment. She sent them out in the street and for 1 hour had them write down everything they observed people doing in a busy public space. At the end of the hour, each student had compiled more than 150 observations. Then she had them do it again for an hour, except they were only allowed to write down observations that they found interesting. The lists were considerably shorter. Suddenly, a man walking across the street wasn't interesting, but a man tossing away a candy wrapper on the pavement, i.e. committing the crime of littering, was. She was trying to make the point that there's a difference between observing and observing with judgment. It's the same in each of our lives. We observe all the time, but we don't often observe with a purpose or with judgment. For one day, write down all the comments that you hear people make to you about you. For example, oh, that was really smart, Marshall. Or, you're late, Marshall. Or, are you listening to me, Marshall? Any remark that, however remotely, concerns you or your behavior, write it down. At the end of the day, review the list and rate each comment as positive or negative. If you look at the negatives, maybe some patterns will emerge. Perhaps a number of remarks will focus on your tardiness, or your inattention, or your lack of follow-up. That's the beginning of a feedback moment. You're learning something about yourself without soliciting it, which means that the comment is agenda-free, it's honest and true. Then do it again the next day, and the next. Do it at home too if you want. Eventually, you'll compile enough data about yourself, without any of your friends and family members being aware that they're giving you feedback, to establish the challenge before you. When a friend of mine tried this for a week, at work and at home, the remark that popped up most often on his negative list was, "Yes, you said that." In effect, people were telling him, "I heard you the first time," which suggested that people found his chronic repetition to be annoying, an easy issue to fix, but he might never have learned it if he hadn't kept the list and searched for a persisting negative. If you have the courage to face the truth, you can do the same. 2. Turn the sound off. I sometimes have clients conduct the following exercise. When they're in a team and starting to get bored, I ask them to pretend they're watching a movie with the sound off. They can't hear what anyone is saying. It's an exercise in sensitizing themselves to their colleagues' behavior. They must ask themselves what's going on around them. One of the first things they see is no different than what they hear with sound on. People are promoting themselves, only with this newfound sensitization. They see how people physically maneuver and gesture to gain primacy in a group. They lean forward toward the dominant authority figure. They turn away from people with diminished power. They cut rivals off with hand and arm gestures. It's no different than what people are doing with the sound on, except that it's more obvious with the sound off. You can do the same for yourself and treat it as a feedback moment. Turn the sound off and observe how people physically deal with you. Do they lean toward you or away? Do they listen when you have the floor, or are they drumming their fingers waiting for you to finish? Are they trying to impress you, or are they barely aware of your presence? This won't precisely tell you what your specific challenge may be, but if the indicators are more negative than positive, you'll know that you aren't making quite the overwhelming impression on your colleagues that you may have hoped for. You'll know you have some work to do. A variation on this drill is making sure you are the earliest person to arrive at a group meeting. Turn the sound off and observe how people respond to you as they enter. What they do is a clue about what they think of you. Do they smile when they see you and pull up a chair next to you? Do they barely acknowledge your presence and sit across the room? Note how each person responds to you. If the majority of people shy away from you, that's a disturbing pattern that's hitting you over the head with some serious truth. You have some serious work to do. The sound off drill doesn't quite tell you what you need to change, but at least you'll know where to start asking, "How can I do better?" You can begin with the people in the room. 3. Complete the sentence. The eminent psychologist, Nathaniel Brandon, taught me how to apply this sentence completion technique, which is a wonderful exercise for digging deep into creative thought, but also works for helping people change. Pick one thing you want to get better at. It could be anything that matters to you, from getting in shape, to giving more recognition, to lowering your golf handicap. Then list the positive benefits that will accrue to you and the world if you achieve your goal. For example, I want to get in better shape. If I get in shape, one benefit to me is that. And then you complete the sentence. It's a simple exercise. If I get in shape, I will live longer. That's one benefit. Then keep doing it. If I get in shape, I'll feel better about myself. That's two. If I get in shape, I'll be a better role model for my family and friends. And so on until you exhaust the benefits. What's interesting about the sentence completion exercise is that as you get deeper into it, the answers become less corporately correct and more personal. You start off by saying, "If I become better organized, the company will make more money. My team will become more productive. Other people will enjoy their jobs more," and so on. By the end, however, you're saying, "If I become more organized, I'll be a better parent, a better spouse, a better person." I employed this once with a general in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was a typical, hard-nosed Marine who resisted the exercise at first. I'm not sure why. But eventually he relented and played along, saying he wanted to become less judgmental. As he began, I could see the proud Marine part of him resisting. He completed the first sentence with a cynical crack about, "If I become less judgmental, I won't have so much trouble dealing with the clowns at headquarters." The second sentence was another sarcastic comment. The third time was less sarcastic. By the sixth sentence, I could see tears in his eyes. "If I become less judgmental," he said, "maybe my children will talk to me again." This may seem like a loopy, backward way of giving yourself good feedback. You start with the suggestion and then determine if it's important. But it works. As the benefits you list become less expected and more personal and meaningful to you, that's when you know that you've given yourself some valuable feedback, that you've hit on an interpersonal skill that you really want and need to improve. That's when you confirm that you've picked the right thing to fix. 4. Listen to your self-aggrandizing remarks. I don't want to get too psychological here, but have you ever listened to a friend brag about how punctual he is? "You can count on me. I'm always on time." When you know that being on time is the last thing you can expect from him. Have you ever heard friends boast about how organized they are when you know they are unmade beds? Or how good they are at follow-up when everyone thinks their responsiveness is a joke? In one of those odd bits of reverse psychology, it seems that the stuff people boast about as their strengths more often than not turn out to be their most egregious weaknesses. None of us is immune to this phenomenon. If it's true about our friends, it's probably true about us. Listen to yourself. What do you boast about? It's quite possible that if you assess this alleged strength as closely as your friends do, it's really a weakness. You shouldn't be bragging about it at all. In a perverse way, you're giving yourself some of the most honest feedback of all. I don't want to twist this into knots of psychobabble, but the same lesson might be on display when you make self-deprecating remarks. When a colleague at a meeting starts off by saying, "Maybe I'm no expert on inventory control," you can be sure that the comments that follow will suggest that he does think of himself as an expert on inventory control. When a friend launches into an argument by saying, "I probably wasn't paying attention," you can be sure that he's planning to show you that he was paying closer attention than you ever suspected. The one that really perks up my ears is, I don't have any ego invested in this. You know immediately that the issue is all about ego. These pseudo self-deprecating remarks, the ones we say about ourselves but don't believe, are the rhetorical devices and debating tricks of everyday communication that allow us to get an edge on our rivals. Nothing wrong with that. To a student of intracorporate warfare, self-deprecation from others should put you on high alert. Whatever you say, you know they believe the opposite. The same could be said of each of us. We should be on high alert when we hear ourselves make self-deprecating remarks, because they might be giving us feedback about ourselves. When you hear yourself make an offhand self-deprecation such as, I'm not very good at thanking people, it's quite possible that you don't believe it. But it's also possible that it's true, that you're saying something piercingly honest about yourself, which you're not yet admitting. You don't thank well. As I say, I don't want to twist every comment we hear and make into knots. Self-deprecation, pseudo or otherwise, can be one of those honest feedback moments that makes a signal sound in our brain. Pay attention, it tells us. This might be something worth observing. 5. Look homeward. Remember the movie Wall Street and the character Gordon Gekko? Michael Douglas won an Academy Award for Best Actor for his portrayal of this rude, larcenous wheeler dealer. Well, I worked with a real-life investment banker who could have inspired the Gekko character. The man I coached, let's call him Mike, wasn't immoral and unethical like Gekko, but he had some competitive fires burning within his soul that made him treat people like gravel in a driveway. They were the pebbles. He was the SUV. When I finished surveying Mike's colleagues about his interpersonal flaw, Mike's score for treating direct reports and colleagues with respect was an astounding 0.1%. That is, out of 1,000 managers rated, he was dead last. But Mike put up equally astounding numbers with his traits. He contributed such vast profits to the firm that the CEO promoted him to the firm's management committee. This should have been the apex of Mike's young career, but it exposed his bad side as well. The firm's leaders, who had been insulated from Mike's behavior, were suddenly in a position to get a first-hand dose of his lead, follow, or get out of my way style. In meetings, they saw that there was no toll booth between Mike's brain and mouth. He was surly and offensive to everyone. He would even mouth off to the CEO, his biggest supporter in meetings. The CEO called me in to work with Mike to fix him. The most obvious thing about Mike when I met him was his delight in his success. He was making more than $4 million a year, so professional validation was coursing through his veins like jet fuel. I suspected that breaking through to Mike by challenging his performance at work would be tough. He was producing, and he knew it. So the first thing I did was sit him down and tell him, I can't help you make more money. You're already making a lot. But let's talk about your ego. How do you treat people at home? He said he was totally different at home, a great husband and father. I don't bring my work home, he assured me. I'm a warrior on Wall Street, but a pussycat at home. That's interesting, I said. Is your wife home right now? Yes, he said. Let's give her a call and see how different she thinks you are at home than at the office. We called his wife. When she finally stopped laughing at her husband's statement, she concurred that Mike was a jerk at home, too. Then we got his two kids on the line, and they agreed with their mother. I said, I'm beginning to see a pattern here. As I told you, I can't help you make more money, but I can get you to confront this question. Do you really want to have a funeral where you're the featured attraction, and the only attendees are people who came to make sure you're dead? Basically, that's where you're headed. For the first time, Mike looked stricken. They're going to fire me, aren't they? He asked. Not only are they going to fire you, I said, but everyone will be dancing in the halls when you go. Mike thought a minute and then said, I'm going to change, and the reason I'm going to change has nothing to do with money, and it has nothing to do with this firm. I'm going to change because I have two sons, and if they were receiving this feedback from you in 20 years, I'd be ashamed. Within a year, his scores in terms of treating people with respect shot up past the 50th percentile, meaning that he was above the already high company norm. He probably deserved even better since he started so far down in the ditch. He also doubled his income, although I cannot claim a direct cause-effect connection for that. The lesson? Your flaws at work don't vanish when you walk through the front door at home. The moral? Anybody can change, but they have to want to change. And sometimes you can deliver that message by reaching people where they live, not where they work. The action plan for leaders and followers. If you want to really know how your behavior is coming across with your colleagues and clients, stop looking in the mirror and admiring yourself. Let your colleagues hold the mirror and tell you what they see. If you don't believe them, go home. Post the same question to your loved ones and friends, the people in your life who are most likely to be agenda-free and who truly want you to succeed. We all claim to want the truth. This is a guaranteed delivery system. These five examples of observed feedback are stealth techniques to make you pay closer attention to the world around you. When you make a list of people's comments about you and rank them, negative or positive, you're tuning in the world with two new weapons, judgment and purpose. When you turn off the sound, you're increasing your sensitivity to others by counterintuitively eliminating the precious sense of hearing. When you try the sentence completion technique, you're using retrograde analysis, that is, seeing the end result and then identifying the skill you'll need to achieve. When you challenge the accuracy of your self-aggrandizing remarks, you're flipping the world upside down and seeing that you're no different from anyone else. Finally, when you check out how your behavior is working at home, you realize not only what you need to change, but why it matters so much. The logic behind these drills is simple. If you can see your world in a new way, perhaps you can see yourself anew as well. Although we've spent a lot of time on feedback here, keep in mind that it is only the baseline of our activity. We are only at the beginning. If I were an orthopedic surgeon, feedback would be like an MRI. I need the MRI to show deep tissue damage and identify what's broken. But I still need to perform an operation to fix the problem, and the patient still needs weeks of diligent rehabilitation to get better. If I were an advertising executive, feedback would be the part where the agency studies the data about the client's product. Who's buying it? Why? What's the market share against competing products? But this research feedback isn't a great commercial. I still have to come up with that on my own. If I were a politician running for office, feedback would be the polling data telling me what's on voters' minds. But I still have to run for election on my own. I still have to convince voters that I'm the right person to deal with their issues. I still have to win votes. Feedback won't do that for me. Feedback tells us to change, not how to do it. But when you know what to change, you're ready to start changing yourself and how people perceive you. You're ready for the next step, telling everyone you're sorry. Chapter 7. Apologizing. The magic move. If it isn't obvious by now, I regard apologizing as the most magical, healing, restorative gesture human beings can make. It is the centerpiece of my work with executives who want to get better, because without the apology, there is no recognition that mistakes have been made. There is no announcement to the world of the intention to change. And most important, there is no emotional contract between you and the people you care about. Saying you're sorry to someone writes that contract in blood. In Harvey Penick's Little Red Book, there's a brief story titled The Magic Move. In Penick's indelible description of the cornerstone of the golf swing, the weight transfer from left to right foot as we take the club back, and then the transfer back to the left foot as we bring our right elbow down and swing the club through the ball. If you learn this, says Penick, you will hit the ball as if by magic. Well, apologizing is my magic move. It's a seemingly simple tactic, but like admitting you were wrong or saying thank you, it's tough for some people to do, but brilliant for those who can. I can't think of a more vivid example of the magic move's cleansing power than Richard Clark testifying before the 9/11 commission. Clark spent hours talking about terrorism to the commissioners, but almost all of his testimony, much of it controversial, was overwhelmed by one moment when he addressed the 9/11 families to say, "Your government has failed you. Those entrusted with protecting you failed you, and I failed you." It's an apology that Frank Rich of the New York Times suggested is likely to join our history's greatest hits video reel, alongside Joseph Welch's, "Have You No Sense of Decency, Sir?" Some thought Clark was grandstanding, or that he had no right to apologize, or that he had injected an overwrought emotionality into the otherwise clinical proceedings. But I applauded, because Clark was doing something that both parties needed. In effect, he was saying, "We can't redo the past. The worst is behind us, and I am still sorry." The apology gave him and the people he was addressing a sense of closure, however faint and bittersweet. Closure lets you move forward. Clark's apology was replayed on television for days. I'm puzzled that anyone was surprised by the emotional wallop packed into his mea culpa. It's what I try to get my clients to do without thinking. Sometimes the message takes longer to get through than I prefer. That's what happened with the senior manager named Ted, with whom I worked in the late 1990s. Ted was the standard issue success story. A smart, personable, hardworking, delivers the numbers and lives by the values type, cherished by his bosses, admired by his colleagues, and loved by his direct reports. There was one reoccurring flaw in this otherwise perfect picture. Ted was disastrous on follow-up with clients and colleagues. It took years for this flaw to get noticed, which explained why all of Ted's relationships started out ecstatically, but eventually drifted into conflict. He alienated the people closest to him, not out of malice or arrogance, but out of passive neglect. He failed to return their calls. He would never make the first move to check up on them to see how they were doing. He would only pay attention to them if there was business to be done. This is the kind of benign, hurtful pattern that emerges only over time, because you only miss nurturing and caring in their absence. But it was a reoccurring pattern with Ted. Somewhere along the way, he had to learn how to show people he cared for them as human beings, that he was their friend, with or without a deal at stake. We helped Ted change for the better at work by applying the magic moves of apologize, advertise, and follow up. That's not the point, though. Ted and I kept in touch, mostly me calling him, of course. But one day in March 2004, he phoned me with exciting news. "Marshall," he said, "you would have been proud of me. I totally screwed up one of my closest friendships." "Okay," I hesitated. "And the reason I should be proud of you is?" "Because I apologized and saved the friendship," he said. The story goes like this. Ted's best friend for 20 years was his neighbor Vince. Over the course of 2 weeks, Vince had called Ted 5 times and Ted never called back. Apparently, the correctives Ted had learned to apply on the job had not quite sunk in his home life. Vince, a volatile Sicilian who valued loyalty and friendship above all else, was hurt and stopped talking to Ted. Ted noticed but couldn't bring himself to contact Vince and apologize. Their respective wives tried to arrange a rapprochement. They decided Ted would write a contrite letter to Vince and all would be well. But Ted messed that up too. Because of business and out-of-town trips, several weeks went by without Ted writing the letter that Vince was now expecting. Finally, Vince boiled over and wrote Ted a stinging letter outlining all the slights and offenses that had poisoned their friendship. Not returning phone calls, ignoring him at a dinner party, never initiating contact. This sounds like a soap opera, but bear with me. This pained Ted enormously, to the point that he immediately wrote Vince a reply. I quote it here in its entirety because it's a model apologia. "Dear Vince, as Vito Corleone said when he sat down with the 5 families, how did it come to this? I read your letter a few minutes ago, and in a first effort to change, i.e. being more responsive, I am writing to address the charges. As I see it, there are 3. To the first count of not calling you back, you are absolutely right. It is rude. It is not how a friend, or even a solid citizen, behaves. I should know better. It sends an unfortunate and incorrect message that I don't care about you. If it makes you feel better, I am democratic about this particular failing. I don't call back my mother, my brother, and my in-laws. My wife says, me too. This is hardly something to brag about. Just a minuscule point of honor on my part to assure you that you are not in the bottom half of some imaginary callback priority list. Apparently, I don't have one. I treat everyone equally, which is to say, rudely. For this, I apologize to you, and I will change that. To the second count of being a poor host when you were at my house, I certainly did not intend to ignore you or leave you out of the conversation. That said, what I remember is not the point. It's what you felt that matters. And this is especially pertinent when the issue is hospitality, extended or withheld. As Boston Celtics coach Red Auerbach used to say about coaching his players, it's not what you say, it's what they hear. You obviously didn't enjoy the evening, and I apologize for that. I like to think of myself as a decent and caring and generous host, and I will make your comments as a signal to do better. To the third count of never initiating a phone call to friends, again, you are right. Absolutely right. Some people, as you say, like to work at friendship. Others don't. Of all the charges you level at me, the third is the one that pains me the most, because it is true and because it is so easily fixed. You are not the first to point this out. I guess I could wander back into my childhood to figure out why I act this way, but looking backward, seeking out scapegoats is a fool's errand. I'm 52 years old. I can't blame my mother or my upbringing or that lousy tuna sandwich in third grade. All I can do is promise to fix my behavior, one step at a time, by taking my cues from you, by doing the things you say a good friend does. Hopefully, my rehabilitation starts with you. The evidence notwithstanding, I do value our friendship. Tremendously. We have too many years of laughs and good times and neighboring and genuine caring for each other to let our friendship slip away because I am a schmuck in an area where you least value that kind of behavior. All I can ask is your forgiveness. If you can grant me that, I do not expect us to return to things the way they were. I think we should aim higher. I would want us to return to things as they should be, where I can aspire to the ideal of friendship that you have described in your honest, painfully honest letter to me. Shall we discuss this over a bottle of red? A great letter, right? But not if it goes unread. Vince sent it back unopened. The wives again interceded, begging Vince to read the letter. When he relented, the process of repairing the friendship was underway, because it is impossible to resist a heartfelt apology. I always wonder about all those people who, like Ted in his former life, can't bring themselves to admit they're wrong or say they're sorry. How do they survive in the world? How do they mend damaged relationships? How do they show others what they're really feeling? How can they declare their willingness to alter their annoying ways without first saying, "I'm sorry"? When I congratulated Ted on his handling of the situation, he said, "You know, if I hadn't gone through this at work, I couldn't have apologized to Vince." "Why can you do it now?" I asked. "Because I know it works." This may be a compelling reason to learn the magic move of apology, but the most compelling is this. It is so easy to do. All you have to do is repeat these words. "I'm sorry. I'll try to do better." Try it sometime. It costs you nothing, not even your illusory pride. But the return investment would make Warren Buffett green with envy. And it will change your life, as if by magic. How to apologize. Do you see a pattern here in the examples of Richard Clark and Ted Vince? The healing process begins with an apology. It doesn't matter what we have done or what compels us to apologize. It could be the intense sorrow you feel for causing someone pain, or the shame of neglecting someone who deserves your attention, or the heartbreak of losing someone's affection for something you've done. Sorrow, pain, shame, heartbreak. These are powerful emotions, sometimes powerful enough to force an apology out of the hardest heart. But that's not the issue here. Cause and motive do not move me. Whatever forces an apology out of people who normally cannot do it, I'm for it. Once you're prepared to apologize, here's the instruction manual. You say, "I'm sorry." You add, "I'll try to do better in the future." Not absolutely necessary, but prudent in my view. Because when you let go of the past, it's nice to hint at a brighter future. And then, you say nothing. Don't explain it. Don't complicate it. Don't qualify it. You only risk saying something that will dilute it. I remember back in 2000.